Okay, last time we were looking at the overlap you can get for two atomic orbitals of the same kind coming together. And we saw that SS and PP pi give pretty fair... Actually, at the distance of a single bond, they're not very different, depending on which atomic orbital you choose. And in fact, at that distance, the biggest one is S with P, remarkably enough. So now how about doing hybrids instead? Because remember, hybrids are going to shift the electron density or the wave function in the direction for overlap. So suppose we choose two sp3s and bring them together to the x's so they're 1.4 apart or whatever apart, and you get this. So it's better than any of the pure orbitals, which doesn't surprise you because you've seen that it distorts the orbitals in one direction so that they could give better overlap. Now, how about if you used a different hybridization like sp squared, which instead of a quarter has a third of s, right? Still better. And if you go to sp, that's the best. Right? In fact, you can go even a little bit further. You can go S squared P with S squared P. An S squared P orbital, what percentage S is it? S squared P. It's two-thirds S. The problem with that would give the best overlap at least at the shorter distances. Right? At the single bond distance, it's not quite as good as SP. At the intermediate distances it crosses, and then it gets a little bit better, right? But it's not so great, because once you've put two-thirds of the S orbital in that, you only have a third of the S to put in any of the other bonds you want that carbon to make, right? So you've used it up. You've been a spendthrift. In fact, from that point of view, what would be the best one to use, the best hybridization, if you want to make four bonds? Yeah, SP3. Then you put only a quarter of S in each one. So that's the weakest of all these, but you can make four of them. If you use all the S up too early, then you have to make do with the P's for what's left, which isn't nearly as good. Right? So SP cubed gets the best four overlaps. But if you're interested in getting the best one overlap, S squared P would be better. But you don't, it's rarely done. Okay, so, but notice that hybrid orbitals overlap about twice as well as the pure orbitals. So it's really worthwhile to do this hybridization stuff. You double the overlap. And the reason is because they allow S to overlap. Each side has both S and P here, both S and P here. So you get S with S, S with P, S with P, and P with P, right? So it turns out that that's really advantageous, that getting that extra S with P is what's so great, because that's the best of all the atomic orbital overlaps. So SP hybridization, SP1 that is to say, gives the best overlap among the common ones, right? But it only allows two orbitals to be made, 50% S in each. Whereas, as we just said, SP3 can give four orbitals with almost as much overlap, with only 25% S in each. So anyhow, hybridization of carbon is really good, and it's not too expensive. It's not like hydrogen, where to get the H2 bond, you only put 2.6% of P in there. Why do you put only 2%? Why don't you make SP hybrid SP1 50-50 for hydrogen? Because it's so expensive, because you're using the 2p orbital with the 1s, whereas in carbon it's 2s and 2p. Not much energy cost to putting a p in there with the s. Sharif?
Is there such thing as s squared p squared?
No, but that would be SP1, right? It's the ratio of the two that you get that exponent shows. In fact, better than S squared P would probably be SP a half. See what I mean? Okay, now, this influence of overlap on the molecular orbital energy we've already seen, but we'll just review it here in the one-dimensional Ervin meets Goldilocks case of a double minimum. So we're going to look at two cases, one where the two things that are overlapping have the same energy, and the other where the two things that are overlapping have different energies. Okay, so case one is the same energy, perfect energy match. So here's the two minima, the double minima, and they have the same energy, the same bottom of both wells, right? And here's the energy of a solution, and it looks like that. But there's going to be another solution that's going to be nearby in energy, and what's it going to look like? It's going to have a node in the middle, right? But almost precisely the same kinetic energy, the same curvature. Just slightly more curvature in order to go through zero rather than almost touching zero, right? So they have the same energy for practical purposes. The red, as you see here, is the same as the green. Okay? Green's just a smidgen higher, but you couldn't really tell it because there's not enough overlap to tell. Right? In the middle, there's essentially no difference. But suppose you increase the overlap. How would you increase the overlap? You could do hybridization, but that's not what I'm talking about. Make the wells closer together so these two waves move closer and overlap. Okay, and that's what's going to be bonding, right, is drawing the nuclei together. Okay, so if we move them closer together to be like that, then there's more difference in the middle, right? There's overlapping of these functions. So now the two look like this, but still the energy is hardly discernible on this scale, the energy difference. No significant energy difference. But if we draw them still closer together and get more overlap, now there's going to be quite a difference between the bonding and the anti-bonding, right? And now you see the anti-bonding is going up in energy compared to what? Compared to when they're completely separated to the individual wells, right? And the favorable one, the bonding one, is going down in energy. So you're getting this splitting. And of course, if you make them still closer together, now it looks almost like it's one well. You can hardly tell that there's this little bump in the middle, right? And now they're split quite far apart, right? So overlap holds the atoms together. Right? If they're separate, they have those energies, the same in the case we're talking about. But if we make 1 over the square root of 2, a plus b and a minus b, we get a splitting. And how big the splitting is, and notice that you're going to have to normalize it, so it'll be a little less and a little greater than 1/2. And what that means, although I'm not telling you exactly how, is that the bottom one doesn't go quite as far down as the top one goes up because of this, right? So the bonding one is not quite as bonding as the anti-bonding one is anti-bonding. But to a first approximation, they're symmetrical. They're the same. Okay, so they actually would shift up like that a little bit, right? So one's more so than the other. Okay, but at any rate, that's if we get greater overlap, we'll get more splitting. Okay? So if we have just one electron, so H2 plus, for example, then that electron, when they're separate, would have that energy. And when you bring them together so they overlap, it has that energy. And that decrease in the electron's energy is what makes it better to have the things together, right? So that you make a bond. Now, suppose B also had an electron. You'd get twice as much. Not quite twice as much. Why not quite twice as much? Because the electrons repel one another, right? But more or less twice as much. Okay, if you had a third electron, it would have to go up because there's only two to a customer here, right? So, and notice that it goes up a little more than the down ones go down, plus there's more electron repulsion, right? So that's not going to be so good. And if you have a fourth electron, then it's really bad. Because the ones that go up more than the ones down. So what do we see? We see that if it's just one electron, we get a little bit of bonding. If it's two electrons, we get strong bonding. If it's three electrons, it's still bonding, but weakly. And if it's four electrons, it's anti-bonding. Right? And that's why helium atoms bounce off one another, because they have four electrons. and the antibonding is worse than the bonding, unless until you get them so far away that the overlap doesn't make any difference, right? And then this correlation energy comes in, that the electrons correlate their movement, which is a little bit favorable. So we get this really, really weak bond between two helium atoms when they're 50 angstroms apart. Right, but that's a different. That's not a normal bond. That's just correlation. Okay, is this clear? How the number of electrons and the fact that they're shifted a little bit up and that there's electron repulsion gives rise to two electrons being by far the best. Yeah.
Does this have anything to do with like double bonding or triple bonding?
Yeah, well, you do it twice. You do the same thing twice if you have double bonds. You do this, there are two bonds and two antibonds. So now you can put four electrons in the two bonds and none in the two antibonds. And if you start putting electrons into the antibonds, then it gets weaker.
Are there any examples of that, like in helium?
Yes. Not with helium, but we'll see some later.
Okay.
Okay. Now, what, if bringing them together to get better overlap is good, why don't they just come all the way together? What stops them? Evan?
The nuclei
repulsion is ultimately going to take over, right? So the electrons do become more stable if you bring the two hydrogens right together to make helium. The electrons become 55% more stable than they are in the H2 molecule. But the proton repulsion, the Coulombic 1 over R, increases much more dramatically. So already it gets as much repulsion as the electrons gain in coming all the way together. It already gets that when you're 0.3 angstroms apart, and then the rest is pure loss. Right? So that's why hydrogen doesn't collapse to helium. Unless you use neutron glue to hold the two protons together so they don't repel one another. And that's what fuels the sun, is D2 becoming helium. So this, we knew that a bond had to be described by something like a Morse potential. And now we know why we have Morse potential. That at the long run, as you increase overlap, the electron pair becomes more stable with increasing overlap, and when you get too close, the nuclear repulsion becomes dominant and stops it from collapsing. Okay, now, in the first lecture, or perhaps it was early in the second, and all this comes from Coulomb's law and Schrödinger's kinetic energy of electrons. And this curve then, once you have this curve, then you can describe the quantum mechanics of nuclear motion. Because, you know, the hard thing is doing the kinetic energy of the electrons, and that we've now done. Okay? Once you do that, then you know the potential is a function of the nuclear positions, which is what's shown here. And now you can use that potential to figure out how the nuclei should move in quantum mechanics. And that's why when we did Erwin meets Goldilocks, we could use a Morse potential. It's not precisely right, but it's the right form for the reason we now know. Now, so finally we understand the atom-atom force law. And remember, that's what Newton posed as the big question. Agents in nature are able to make the particles of bodies stick together by very strong attraction, the business of experimental philosophy to find them out. And we found it. Right? Now, we had a preview of this and a little vote, as you may remember, in the first or second lecture. So let's go back to review that. So, and we're going to vote again, see if we've learned something here. How many people say gravity? None said that before. Anybody now? No, still zero. I'll tally it here. See how we're doing. Zero again. How about electrical forces? It was unanimous before. Anyone doesn't want electrical forces, Coulomb's law? Okay, still unanimous. Okay, magnetic forces. We had 10 before. No, although spin, which has to do with magnetism, is a little bit related. That's what means you can only put two electrons in each orbital. But that's a secondary consideration, or it's actually very important. But it's not really what holds them together. Okay, so I don't get any votes for that now. Although it's sort of qualified. kinetic energy. We had five before. Anybody know? No, it's going to be easier to count the no's. Okay, it's now unanimous. Quantum forces, we had 20 before. There is no such thing as quantum forces, right? Okay, none there. Shared electron pairs. Anybody doesn't think it has to do with shared electron pairs? But that's because you're so sophisticated now, right? It really is these electron pairs that are holding things together. They're going down in energy with increasing overlap. So it was all but one before. I'm going to say it's all but one now, but we're sophisticated. Quarks? No. No. Strong force? No. Had five before. Weak force? No, didn't need that. Strange attractors? 12. We had 12 before. You still like them, Jordan? Okay, we got one. That's Jordan. Okay, exchange of photons? Why? Right, because physicists tell us that some aspects of the electromagnetic force are actually carried by exchange of photons, but that we don't talk about. That's over across the way here. So we're sophisticated there too. An exchange of virtual particles. I don't think that has anything to do with it in our circumstances. So we got no votes there. Hey, we're doing a lot better. So you've learned something. Okay, that's the one we'll record. Okay, so we talked about overlap. Now we're going to talk about energy match. Because we're going to look at we looked at this case where the A and B had the same energy. That's what we just did. And we saw splitting is proportional to overlap, or at least approximately proportional to overlap. You also have this less than, greater than a half thing, which has to do with that. Okay, but what if the partner's lower in energy than A? What if it's down here? Okay. Now, why use any of an inferior orbital? And I see that I improved this thing a lot, but somehow I have the wrong version of the talk in here. This is all screwed up. Let me see what I get next. I've lost the important slide. So let me go back and tell you this. Although I'm going to put the actual slide in the one that you'll see, so it'll be a lot better than my using my hands. Okay, now suppose you have these two orbitals, right? This is a beautiful slide when you ultimately see it. And one of them's high in energy and one's low in energy. You're going to put them A and B together. Okay? Now, why should you use, it won't be a 50-50 mix anymore, the best mix. Which will it be more, A or B? The lowest energy orbitals, much more A than B. That's obvious. But why put any of B in? Why not just 100% A if that's lower? It's because when you put a little B in, right, you get a little overlap, which shifts the electrons. Now, it shifts the electrons two ways. It shifts electrons, obviously, on to B and away from A, right? And we get that because it's a large amount of A, small amount of B, right? We square that wave function, and now we get the square of whatever amount of A we had there, really big, and the square of whatever B was, really small now because it was already small before we squared it. Everybody with me on that? So we put a little bit of A on to B, which is bad because B is higher than A. Okay? But we don't put very much there because we're going to square it to get the density. So we put just a little bit. But at the same time, we have that overlap, which is going to be 2AB. Right? And although B is small, A is big. So AB is sort of small because B is small, but it's nothing like as small as B squared is. Does that make sense to everyone? It's much prettier on the slide, you'll see. Okay, so so the amount you shift from A to B is really tiny, but the overlap is significant. Now, where does that overlap extra density come from? It comes not from the nucleus of A, it comes from down here on A, shifting from here up to there. So it's the same distance from A. That doesn't hurt it, right? But it's also close to B, which is good, right? If you have to be a certain distance of A from A, it's better to be close to B than not to be close to B. So the big deal is that the square of B is much smaller than 2AB, right? So you don't have to put much extra density from A to B in order to get to profit from that overlap shifting in that direction within the A atom. Got the idea? So that's why you use any of an inferior orbital, and the slide will give you details on that. I don't know what happened here. I think probably the one you downloaded has the right stuff in it. And notice that if you don't have... Why was it good to mix this bad one in there? Because of the overlap. If you don't have any overlap, or the overlap's really tiny, then there's no advantage to doing that. Right? Then you don't mix it. And that's what happens in the core orbitals. They're held so close to the nuclei, they don't overlap significantly. Right? So there's no reason to mix them. And we saw this last time. Remember, the lowest one was pure F. And the next one was all on oxygen. And the next one was on this carbon. And the next one was on that carbon. But when you get the 2S and hybrid orbitals and so on, then they overlap. And now it's not... So there's what we say, the compact core did indeed remain pure. But if you get them big enough so that you can overlap, then that fights against this difference, intrinsic difference of the orbitals, and you begin to get some O together with the F, like that. And a little bit of the C. Why that C and not the other C? Because that C just happens to be the right place where this orbital is, right? So it's nice to contribute to it if it's already there. Okay. Oh, in fact, this is that other slide. I don't know how that one got in. Okay, there's where we square it. There are the two energies. Here are the two with A much less than B, right? Why use any of the inferior orbital? Because you can profit from shifting the electron density without paying the high cost, because the high cost is mitigated by the fact that, in this case, I call it A is really small. A squared is really small. And here's a specific example. If you have this much A and this much B, that's how much A squared, how much B squared, and how much 2AB. And you see the 2AB is very much bigger than the A squared, so forget the A squared. You profit by doing that. Okay, now, let's look at it in one dimension and see the same thing. Now these two wells are not the same depth. One is a little bit higher than the other. Right? So here's the lowest energy orbital, all in the left one, the lower one. Here's the next orbital, that's negligible mixing. The other one is all in the right. Right? They're not mixing because they're not overlapping. As if we, and there's a splitting, a difference in energy, but it's only the difference in energy that you already had here, that this one is higher than that one. This is not due to the overlapping because there's so little overlap. But if you begin to bring them together like this, then you get a little bit more mixing, but still not enough to be visible there. Still just the original. But now you can see that the energies are rising and small falling, right? And now there's really a big splitting, as there was when the energies were matched at the beginning. Although it's not purely symmetrical. It's still, the favorable one is a little more on the left, a little more on the left, and the unfavorable one is a little more on the right. Okay, so increasing overlaps fights this difference in energy. You'd rather be in the lower well, but the overlap fights against that and tends to make it in both wells. Okay, so how did this work out? We can actually do it sort of semi-quantitatively there. So the favorable one is mostly C, the unfavorable one is mostly A and has a node. But you had larger energy shifts when they had the same energy, and it didn't cost anything to mix them, right? Now, and smaller energy shifts when it's costing energy to incorporate A into C, as well as profiting from the overlap. So that one looks mostly like C, both in shape and in energy, and the other one looks mostly like A, both in shape and energy, but it's a little worse than A, as the good one is a little better than C. Now, this is just sort of a mathematical trick that's fun. There's a certain energy mismatch okay, between A and C, and A and B are the same. And there's a certain amount of overlap that if there was perfect match would give a certain amount of splitting. Okay? Now, suppose you have both the energy mismatch and the same amount of overlap. How can you put them together to see what the result is going to be? Well, what you do is that energy in the middle of that arrow is the average of A and C. So we bring that over there. Okay, now we're going to take how much the overlap would cause splitting if they were the same, right? And we're going to tip it down and to at right angles to this other arrow that had to do with the difference in energy of the atoms. And we're going to make a box around it and draw the diagonal. And now we're going to bring in a pin to pivot in the middle and rotate it until that's vertical, and that's the result. It's cute. That's how big they'll be, that's the energies you'll get. Except, and notice that the new splitting is going to be bigger than the old splitting, if I compare the two with one another. The new splitting is bigger, right? But then we have to take into fact this normalization, a little less than, a little greater than. So we're going to just shift that up a smooch like that, right? Just a little bit. And that's where we're going to get the new ones. That's these new ones, right? So we got a little stabilization and a little destabilization. Stabilization for the bonding compared to two electrons being in C. Destabilization for the antibonding compared to two electrons being in A. And for a given overlap, the shift is not as big, right? The red arrows aren't as big as the blue arrows. So for a given overlap, you get the best shift if the two energies are the same. If the energies are different, they're fighting one another, one energy being better, but overlap helping, right? Still, A plus C ends up lower than A plus B. No doubt about that. That's clear from this, if you go back and look at this construction we did to get the energies. It's got to be that A plus C ends up lower than A plus B. Now, the splitting is less sensitive to the lesser contributor of these differences, mismatch or overlap. For example, if the mismatch was relatively large, that's the orange thing, the mismatch of A to C, and the overlap was very small, that's the blue arrow, then the diagonal isn't very different from the orange. Everybody see that? So if you, a little bit of overlap doesn't help you much if they're very different from one another, right? It's whichever one, you can see from this, from the diagonal of the rectangle, that whichever one is big will dominate, then the other one just make a little bit of difference. And of course, if they were more or less the same, then they'd both be important as the energy match and overlap. So now, important generalizations based on this. Mixing two overlapping orbitals gives one new orbital that's lower in energy, that's the one that doesn't have a node, and one that's higher in energy than either of the parents. Right? So no matter where they start, when you bring them together, you'll get something lower than the lower of the starting, something higher than the higher one. Okay, they're going to split apart. The lower energy combination looks more like the lower energy parent. Right? The shape of the electron is going to be mostly near wherever it's happier in energy. Both in shape and in energy, they'll be closer. And the higher one will look mostly like the higher energy parent in shape and in energy. For a given overlap, increasing energy mismatch decreases the amount of mixing. They're fighting one another. And it decreases the magnitude of the energy shifts that you get from the mixing because you don't have so much mixing. Okay. Now, the AC electrons are clearly lower in energy when you have the same overlap for AB and AC, right? The AC is clearly lower in energy. But there's another, we don't care about that so much. What we care about is how strong the bond is. Okay? Now let's look at that. Which bond is stronger, AB or AC? Just give me your intuition on this. Which do you think is stronger, AB or AC?
AC.
Or don't you trust me when I'm asking questions anymore? AC looks like it should be stronger. Okay, because it comes down, it's down further. But let's look. Compared to what? Compared to when they're separate. Okay, now let's look at this. Compared to what? Okay, so suppose we start with two electrons in C in one case, or two electrons in B in the other case. And if we have to pull AC apart, these two electrons in the bonding orbital have to go to C. Right? And if we pull AB apart, those two electrons in the AB orbital have to go to B. Okay? Which is harder? AB is much, you have to raise the electrons in AB more. Right, Jordan? So it's a stronger bond. AB is stronger. Right? More energy to break it. Right? If that's what happens, if the two electrons go to C in one case and the two electrons go to B in the other case. Right? So that, so AB is stronger if you're forming ions, A plus, B minus. The two electrons are going to B. Got the idea? And that's called heterolysis. Hetero means unsymmetrical or different, right? So you break it into one that's plus and the other's minus. That's heterolysis. Lysis means splitting. Derek?
If the energy difference between the bonding orbital for AB and the energy levels for A orbital and B orbital are the same, why don't they just evenly split?
Say that again, please. I didn't quite get it.
The energy difference between the bonding orbital and A seems to be equal to the energy difference between the bonding orbital.
The difference from what?
That blue line?
The blue line here is further from A and B in energy than the red is from C. Are you on board with that? And you still have a problem?
Yeah. The thing I'm asking is, you said that when the bond breaks that the two electrons both go to B?
Yeah, or they could both have gone to A.
Why don't they just go one to B?
It's possible, but that's not heterolysis, which we're talking about. Okay, but now suppose one goes to A and one goes to B. That's what you want to talk about. And in the other case, one goes to A and one goes to C. Okay? It's a different way of breaking, because now we're forming atoms, A dot and C dot, not A plus and C minus. Okay? Now, which one's harder to break? Derek, you got us started on this. You can get us out of it. What?
It's AC.
AC's harder because that one electron has to go up so high to get over to A. Okay? So in that case, AC is stronger. So it depends on what you're talking about as to which bond is stronger. Normally, when people talk about bond strength, they talk about homolysis, symmetrical breaking, one electron going each way. And in that case, the energy mismatch makes bonds stronger. Everybody, you want to think about that just a second to see if you agree with me? If you have mismatch, the bond will get stronger if you're breaking one electron each way. And that's what usually you're talking about when you talk bond strength. But often there are things where you break A plus B minus, and it's just the opposite. So mismatch hinders homolysis, makes it harder. Energy mismatch. Now, you might wonder, is all this true? Okay. So what is the experimental evidence that shows us that all this, these fairy tales have some basis? Well, let's look at, compare H2 with HF. In H2, the two orbitals are exactly matched in energy, the two hydrogens. But in HF, they're mismatched. Why? Which one is a lower energy orbital? Why?
Because
it has so many more protons. And if we look at the lowest energy bonding sigma orbital, it's symmetrical in the case of H and unsymmetrical in the case of HF. Okay, in the direction you suppose that the electrons are mostly on the F, but a little bit on the H. It's not round, it's oval. And the reason it's oval is to get electrons near the H. If they're at a certain distance from the fluorine, they might as well be near H also. Okay? So it's big on F. Now, there's also the antibonding orbital, right? Which has a node. It's called sigma star. And it's big on H in the case of HF. Why is it big on H? Why wouldn't it also like to be big on F? Mike? No, no. F is lower in energy. Definitely. Right? But the F is already used. You can't put more than two electrons in that orbital, in the F orbital. You've already used that part of space. Right? Now what's left over is the H and a little bit of the F that you didn't use in the first one. So you're using the leftovers to make the sigma star. Here's F and here's H. You put them together. This one's mostly F. This one's mostly H. I mean, it would prefer to be F too, but you can't put that many electrons in the F. Yeah.
Sorry, what is star?
Star means anti-bonding. So it's the anti-bonding combination of H and F. Sharif?
Why does the sigma come before the sigma star? In terms of why?
You mean lower in energy?
Yeah.
Because A, you tell me, what's good about the first orbital on the right as compared to the second one? How about kinetic energy?
Oh.
It has no nodes. The top one has node.
So the top one has more kinetic energy.
Has more kinetic energy. And the lower one is more concentrated where the protons are, on F. The other one's on H, where there aren't as many protons. So both potential and kinetic energy, you'd expect that. Mike?
When you talk about sigma bonds, which orbital in F is bonding with the 1s?
It's mostly the 2s. There's, of course, the core electrons of fluorine, the 1s, but those we just consider to be part of the nucleus. So it's mostly 2s, but a little bit of 2p also to give better overlap. Okay? Okay, so that one's big on H. There are two electrons in that one. That one's empty for these valence electrons that we're talking about. That's an antibonding molecular orbital, which is what the star means. And it's antibonding because you have this node here. And also there's an antibonding node here between the two nuclei, right? The two wave functions came together. Now this one up there, to the extent that it's on fluorine, has a little bit of p orbital on fluorine, not all s, right? So there's another node in that one, but that's not a node that resulted in antibonding. That node was already there because of the atomic orbital you're using. So that's an atomic orbital node. That doesn't lead to antibonding. It's the black node that makes it antibonding, the one that depletes electron density between the nuclei. The other one is just what construction set you were building from, that it had some p orbital on F.
It looks for the hydrogen that the antibonding orbital located around it looks like a 2s. Is that because that if you had more electrons, they wouldn't be able to go to the hydrogen?
What you're using from the hydrogen is only the 1s. There's probably, you know, like 0.02% of the 2s or something in the best mixture, but it's not very much. It's mostly, whatever it looks like, it's mostly 1s. The reason it's got this node is because of the p orbital interfering with it from fluorine. Okay, so now what's the heterolysis, right, to A plus B minus? How much does it hurt, how much does it cost in energy? Kilocalories per mole in the gas phase to make H plus and H minus, it costs 400. HF, it costs only 373. Does it surprise you that it's easier to break HF into H plus and F minus than to break H2 into H plus and H minus? What do you call HF? Hydrofluoric acid. Why? Because it does this, right? Because it can more easily, you don't call hydrogen hydrogenic acid, right? Because it's hard to break it into H plus, H minus. Okay? So the HF bond is weaker. Okay? On the other hand, because you call it hydrofluoric acid. On the other hand, if you break it to atoms, H dot, F dot, then it's 32 kilocalories stronger for HF So if you, so if I say, which bond is stronger, HF or H2, what do you say? Compared to what? Are you breaking it to plus minus heterolysis, or are you breaking it to two atoms? Right? And it's the opposite for obvious reasons based on what we've seen here today. So the HF bond is stronger. And usually, as I said, when you see a table of bond strengths, this is what you're talking about, a table of bond strengths. So HF, you know, it seems funny to people. Tell your roommate this. Ask him, which bond do you think is stronger, H2 or HF? Remembering that HF easily breaks apart into H plus and F minus. Right? But the bond strength is much stronger for HF because of the energy mismatch. Only because it's made from a 2s on fluorine. So down really close to the nucleus, there's that little spherical node, or a little bit distorted. Okay, now, here's our reality check on whether this hybridization stuff we've talking about is worth anything. And it has to do with the structure and dynamics of XH3 molecules. So there are three molecules we're going to talk about today, and mostly tomorrow, or Monday, BH3, CH3, and NH3, which are all the same, except that you add an extra proton to the nucleus to make boron into carbon and another one to make nitrogen. And of course, at the same time you add the protons, you add electrons. So you have 3, 4, and 5 valence electrons. Right? And what we're going to try to do is see what orbitals should we use for those electrons, and what hybridization should we use, and what implication does that have for the geometry and for the dynamics of these XH3 molecules. Now, there should be a relationship between hybridization and structure, and I want to show you why that is. So here's an sp hybrid orbital. We've seen it before. Here it's just schematic, but you know it looks like that. And suppose, but what you don't want to do, what you can't do, is use the same orbital twice for two electron pairs. That violates the Pauli principle that you can only put two electrons in any one orbital. So if the two hybrids were just like this, you can't do it. But suppose I turned one by 3 degrees. Can I now put two electrons in it? Sure. How about if I turn it by 1/10 of a degree? Sure. How about if I turn it by 1/1000 of a degree? You sure about that? Because they're mostly the same orbital. The only way for them to be different orbitals is to not have any overlap. So if you want to put 4 electrons in, the two orbitals that you're going to use must not overlap with one another. Because if they have any overlap, to the extent they have overlap, they're the same orbital. Okay, so you could put one in an S and one in a P because those are orthogonal. Okay, you have to choose orthogonal orbitals. So suppose we have one that's in an SP orbital and another one that's in an SP3 orbital, and I'm interested in what the angle between those is. Okay, so what's that angle? Okay, well, here's a mathematical relationship for people who are looking at that relates the angle to what M is and what N is in SPM and SPN. Right? Now, we can, and if they obey that, then they're orthogonal to one another. If they're at that angle, they have no net overlap, and then you can put electrons in both of them. So suppose we're going to make a table here, you're going to help me, of M, N, and angle. So suppose we have SP1 and SP1. So M and N are both 1. So two SP hybrids on the same atom. Right? These are on the same atom. What angle will they make? What angle has the cosine of minus the square root of 1? It's 180. Right? And you know that. You had that in high school, right? That SP hybrids point like this. Okay. Now how about if it's SP2? This is 2... And this is 2. What's the cosine? The cosine is 1 over the minus 1 over the square root of 2 times 2 minus a half. Do you know what angle is has a cosine of minus a half? 120 degrees, right? So that's trigonal, right? Like the Mercedes sign, 120 degrees. Okay? How about if it's SP3? Now it's minus a third. Now, if you had done a lot of things like this, you recognize that's a very important angle, whose cosine is a third. It's the tetrahedral angle, 109.5 degrees. Right? Now, how about if M is 1, is anything not 0? If M was 0, SP0 would be a pure S orbital. Okay, but it's not. It's something that has at least a little bit of P in it. And the other one is a pure P orbital. See that? Okay. Now, so what should the angle now be? Its cosine is minus 1 over infinity. No, not 0. M is not 0. It's something like a tenth or something. It's 90 degrees, right? So if you have some p orbital in one of them, at least some, and another p orbital, they have to be 90 degrees to one another. Okay, and now how about the case we have? SP1 and SP3, that turns out to be 125.3 degrees. So there's a relationship between hybridization and geometry. That's what I wanted to tell you. So what we're going to do then is to discuss next time, how do we optimize the hybridization of the X atom in XH3 when we put one X electron in each of three bonding atomic orbitals? The other one's going to be a hydrogen, right, to give the other electron to that bond. And whatever's left over, no electrons in the case of boron, one in the case of carbon, two in the case of nitrogen, are going to go into the fourth atomic orbital of that carbon. Three of them are being used to bond to hydrogen. The fourth either has 0 or 1 or 2 electrons. And what is the hybridization going to be? And therefore, what's the geometry going to be? Because if we know the hybridization, we know the angles. Okay, we'll do that next time.
When you're talking about the H and the F, I'm sort of confused. So, like, the really simplistic diagram with just one line for H and one line for F, like, if they had different, that's considering, like, just one orbital, right?
Yeah, the orbital on fluorine could be hybridized.
Right.
It might not be a pure 2s orbital.
Okay, so it could be just, like, one of the two P's. What about the other electrons? They just, like, don't interact?
Well, they're going to be unshared pairs on fluorine, too. They're going to need to use some of the other orbitals on fluorine. And that'll be some of the same balancing act that we're going to talk about in XH3. Are you going to put the S character into making bonds, or are you going to use it to hold lone pairs or something? See the idea? That same consideration is going to occur to fluorine in HF.
Okay.
Am I going to use my S character in making a bond, or am I going to use it to hold an unshared pair? And in fact, there are going to be three unshared pairs on fluorine.
Okay. All right.
Okay.
Hey, I just realized that I had a wiki for the Wednesday lecture.
Yeah, I noticed.
I just saw it. Well, because I had one on Monday, I didn't even look for the Wednesday one.
We got so many people, and we got a lot of wikis.
Yeah. So
do it, and you'll lose a point for being late, but then you'll still get some credit.
Thanks.
I was just wondering, where did the angle formula, what is that from?
Oh, it's just if you know the overlap of S with S and P with P and S with P, and I gave you those.
You're just doing like
depends
on percent of,
right? That you know that. Let's do it here. So an SP hybrid has some S and some P. So one of the hybrids has a certain amount of S. The other one has a certain amount of S, maybe less. And the first one has a certain amount of P. A certain P. and the other one has a p that's at a different angle, so that one will point this way and the other will point that way. Okay?
Yeah. I was trying.
Now, you know that this one that's at an angle is a certain amount of this p plus a certain amount of this p. We talked about that before, how you change the angle by mixing it. Right? Now, to the extent that this one is made up of this, those overlap, and the S also overlaps. The S doesn't overlap with P.
Right.
But P, this part of this P overlaps with this P, and the S overlaps with this S. But they must have opposite signs and cancel if they're to be orthogonal. And that'll depend on how much of this P you put into there to make up for how much overlap you're getting in S. And if you take that into consideration, because remember, this how much of this is in this depends on what that angle is.
Right.
We saw that before with atom in a box.
Yeah.
So that's where the formula comes from, to make it so that so the S with S cancels the P with P. And there's no net overlap of the two hybrids.
Okay. For
2SP hybrids. And of course it depends on how much of each of these P's you use and how much of the S's you use.
Okay.
So that S with S cancels P with P.
Anyway.
HF bond. Isn't there hydrogen bonding?
That hydrogen bonding is two HFs, holds two HF molecules together.
Okay.
We're talking about covalent bonding, the HF bond itself, not two HF molecules.
Okay, thank you.
Questions on previous exams?
Yeah.
On the 2007 exam, I think there was you had an atom of formaldehyde. And you had the two
molecule of formaldehyde. And
you had the two molecular orbitals based on, and they have they're analogous to 3D atomic orbital. I was wondering how you can determine which one had the lower energy.
Well, you have you're talking about the double bond part, the p orbitals overlapping of the carbon and the oxygen because it's a double bond.
Mm-hmm.
We've been talking here mostly about sigma orbitals.
Oh.
But we're talking about the double bond now. So you have an oxygen orbital and a carbon orbital, two p orbitals parallel to one another. They overlap. Mm-hmm. Which one's going to be lower in energy? Carbon or oxygen?
Oxygen.
Why?
It has more protons.
Yeah. So this is a classic case of two orbitals that have different energies,
mm-hmm.
oxygen lower than carbon, but they overlap a little bit. Right? So it's exactly what we talked about today. It's the mixing, because of overlap, of mismatched energies.
Mm-hmm.
So what will the lower combination is going to look mostly like what?
Oh, mostly like the oxygen p orbital.
And it's going to have no node between them?
Okay.
And the other one will be anti-bonding and will look mostly like carbon.
Okay. Okay. Thank you.
It's easy, huh? So you're all set?
Mm-hmm.
Good.
Thanks.
Yep.
I think